Welcome to NACSW's Podcast of the Month. Our podcast program makes available recordings of a wide variety of NACSW presentations and discussions on topics of particular interest to Christians in social work. Our Podcast of the Month program features a new podcast every 30 days for your listening pleasure. We hope you enjoy today's podcast.
All right, I have the pleasure of introducing Dr. Lee to you today. Dr. Lee is a licensed clinical social worker and a certified alcohol and other drug counselor in the state of Illinois. He has over 25 years of clinical experience in a variety of mental health settings, a doctorate of psychology in clinical psychology, and has taught with us at ONU since 2007. So our social work department is pleased to welcome Dr. Lee as today's featured speaker.
Thank you. Good morning, and welcome back to Olivet. It's almost spring break. It's happy Friday. Yeah. It's March. It's a CEU event that I'm speaking at, and in March of 2012, I was also speaking at an event for a nursing program, and we had a stretch day after day after day in 2012 of 75 to 80 degree weather. I figured I was the good luck charm. We've fallen a bit short. All I can do is quote Maxwell Smart. Sorry about that, Chief. We will do what we can. The first few, and I've got to tell you, I've stepped more boldly into the 21st century. I have a clicker that I will try to make work, but I have assistance over here. Thank you. Oh, God. The first few slides are a potpourri of information related to just getting warmed up for the topic, and then we will shift gears into spiritual assessments, hopefully equipping you with some ways to enhance your assessment that we have with clients. And then we will shift into our final section, looking at the role, the history of spirituality and addictions, and specifically recovery. So, this is just a bit about what we will be doing, and I'm just going to go quickly through these slides, but you should have everything in your packet, as well as the PowerPoint slideshow that you can follow along. So these are some of the things we'll be talking about. We will have, in addition to the slideshow, I have two video clips, one related to spirituality, another related to addictions and recovery, especially the incredible moment when almost the birth of Alcoholics Anonymous was able to take place. Additionally, in your package, you will notice that there's an article. We won't be getting to the entire article, but there is about two and a half pages that we will look at as well. And so these are some things that I hope we can touch on that you'll be more empowered as you leave here today. Can you tell I stepped into the 21st century? I had fun making all these. All right. But just a bit about me and how come. I've been thinking about this topic for getting close to a year now. I've been getting more excited about that the more I read about it. But perhaps many of you share some of these similar experiences. I have been, well, in May, it'll be 30 years that I have been in the field. And I suspect I share this with many of you, that we have heard stories of times of pain in general of life. And sometimes there have been people who have somehow, some way been wounded in the process of expressing their spirituality, being involved with religion. Arguably one of my favorite words in the English language is resiliency, the bounce back, the growth that comes through adversity and trials. I'm old, and so I go way back, old music. Any Bob Dylan, know the name? Some? All right. There was a time when Dylan closed himself off in, I believe, a hotel room, and he pored over the Bible day after day after day, and he came out and he proclaimed the name of Jesus. He was born again, and he put out, I believe, two albums, and One of them was called Slow Train Comin', and it is one of my favorite albums, period. But I thought about that as I was preparing, because one of his songs was, you're going to have to serve somebody, no matter what. And so that fits in well with the idea that how we're going to define spirituality, how religion fits. We're going to have to somehow acknowledge a power greater than us. I have had a longstanding and deep appreciation of Native Americans and how they embrace, understand spirituality. And I just have a name down. R. Carlos Nakai is arguably the most well-known musician of Native American music. I thought about actually having the music playing as he came in, but it might be a bit too sedating. But I encourage you. And you just see the title of that, Earth Spirit, the connection of all around us that is sacred. My background has been steeped in work with addictions and recovery. Hopefully you'll be as fascinated with the story of Bill Wilson, the start of Alcoholics Anonymous. I never am comfortable saying that I have an expertise in some area, because I'm always growing. There's always something to learn, and clients will teach me things that no textbook could ever do. But working with adult children of alcoholics helped me to really appreciate their question of who they are. So a lot of things influenced, and if there wasn't anything else that could influence me, well, yeah, it may be in the future. It is in the future for some people in this room. It's a wonderful thing, and my focus was on spirituality, adult children of alcoholics, and what impact being raised in an alcoholic family system had on their developing spirituality. But I had as the title, along with this, a funny thing happened on the way to getting to know somebody. And I put that up there for a couple of reasons. First of all, is that article after article after article that I read kept referring back to the fact that spirituality is a powerfully important experience for all of us, but social workers have virtually no training for that. And just article after article after article kept saying, essentially, what's up with that? I was very fortunate in my doctorate program to have some training, which was wonderful. My dissertation chair is also an ordained minister, chair of the Master's in Counseling program at Adler. And so he was able to really expose us to that. But the other was an experience that I had prior to joining the faculty at Olivet. I was a counselor, and one of the aspects of my job was an employee assistance program counselor. So in addition to the contracts that we had, we would also have arrangements at managed care companies. And anytime I would receive a referral from one particular company, I got the standard line from the individual making the referral. If a client brings up matters of religion or spirituality, I was to refer that individual to their pastoral care. I was not to touch that. And it was very clear over the telephone, don't you do that, Barry, because Big Brother is watching and he, she, or it will find out. So that's kind of the what's up with the title for that. But we're going to start out, again, this is the potpourri of aspects that we have, spirituality, religion. They're distinct but certainly overlapping. So my question to y'all is, how do you define those two words? Say more. Yes.
In my mind, when you say religion, it's more of a specifically defined, set of beliefs or process, whatever, where spirituality is more general, feeling that there's something beyond you that, you know, that sort of supersedes things.
Okay, super, thanks. Anyone else? I've got to admit, not given a tremendous amount of thought about defining until I started pouring myself into the dissertation topic. And we're going to get an extremely small sample of all the different types. So religion. Very current material, 1902, William James. He was an individual whose training was psychology. He was with, I believe, Harvard. But he became more and more and more invested in understanding matters of spirituality and religion in the lives of individuals as it pertained to their psychological health. And so, trying to define religion, the feelings, acts, and experiences of individual men in their solitude, so far as they apprehend themselves to stand in relation to whatever they may consider divine. Take a breath. Yeah. Next, another about religion. Zimbauer and Pargament, to well-authored individuals. Personal group search for the sacred that unfolds within, again, as you see the context. And your first, Steve, is that correct, gentlemen? Your first name, I'm sorry. See, I was thinking it was Steve. Thank you. Yeah. My blank look really does mean those. Yeah. What I don't know, I make up. You see the context. Organized system, as Steve mentioned, is within boundaries, religion. The one little fun fact that I have, you see the lead author of the second example, Kanda. Ed Kanda was one of my teachers when I was beginning my master's degree program 100 years ago. Considered one of the big names, in especially within social work, looking at the role of spirituality. He's multicultural. He married a woman from South Korea. We got to see photographs of the wedding ceremony. He really embraces understanding the spiritual experience of humans. And then we get into spirituality, and this gives us a question. It poses a question to us. Should the term spirituality encompass a quest for meaning, irrespective or regardless of whether it relies on secular or sacred means, or should it be restricted to a search for meaning that does involve somehow a reference to God, the transcendent? So it asks this question, how very God-transcendent being should it contain? How broad, how wide the net can it be? And then the shorter relationship with God, notice, very focused on that, or whatever is held to be ultimate transcendent, that fosters the sense of meaning, purpose, mission in life. And the longer I'm in this field, the more I appreciate a couple of many things, in that we are all meaning makers. We are searching for meaning in our lives. And so many times clients would come to me and in some form or another, a spiritual crisis. Who am I at this point? The lights don't seem to be on. I'm in a dark time in my life. I do want to pause and point out David Hodge is the author of that second quote. He and Dr. Ray Palauzian are two individuals I'm very indebted to. They were both so gracious to grant me permission to share their material with you. So I thank them very kindly for that. But that's the closest I could come to a gong kind of sound. Survey says, Richard Dawson, arguably the biggest flirt that was on television for many years with Family Feud. This, as I was looking through research, trying to find more contemporary, just how is America thinking about this topic? And this is just a very small sampling. There was a whole bunch to do that. But if ever you are intrigued to learn a bit more, the Pew Research Center, specifically, I looked at the religion and public life aspect. I suspect that first line is not a surprise to many, if not all of you, that we have had a sense, a mindset, if you will. This is specific to America. Hey, I'm a spiritual person. I don't know if I'd call myself religious or not. And that is a pervasive. One thing I was surprised about, I don't know if any of you share it, but I was surprised to learn that there's been a decline going for what could close to be 50 years of less dedication to what we might put in the category of religious ritual, prayer, belief in a specific being God, and definitely regular worship attendance. But notice the flip of that. As much as there's been a decline in certain demographics, as we age, there's a greater appreciation of our relationship with the transcendent, of the rituals that would be consistent with not just our spiritual life, but specifically with religious observances as well. Little bit more. This almost goes counter to the first thing that I had with the Pew Research. David Hodge, as well as many others, are talking to us social workers, and they're saying it's an important mindset to get into that our clients typically are interested in discussing, learning, embracing this concept. So I think the call to us is, how do we introduce, how do we incorporate in a way that's comfortable, that is literally feeling safe to our clients to tap into something that person after person after person says, this is important to our clients. How do we find a way to connect with them? So what Hodge mentions is that sometimes clients will volunteer this. Sometimes we need to dig a little bit deeper. So one of many ways, certainly not necessarily be taken verbatim, but to introduce the topic. Many people identify spirituality as a personal strength, and those words, personal strength, emerge in the literature over and over again, and it's words that we all know well in our field as strength-based assessment. To incorporate that means, per this literature, that we find ways to tap into spirituality because that is a personal strength, and to think strength-based challenges us to find a way to incorporate that as well. So would you be interested in exploring if this could be of help? And it runs the gamut from, oh, thank you for the invitation, to not in your life, and don't bring it up again or else. It'll run the gamut. So these are, again, this is in the potpourri of things, but Oakes and Raphael are really just wonderful writers, and they're very consistent with Christianity in their writing. That's their background. But just some guides, some questions as you are assessing with your clients. I've read both perspectives, and I think they're both very valid depending upon what your comfort level is, how much time you have to work with clients. Some authors really encourage that spiritual assessment is overlaid with the assessment that you are generally doing with your clients. Others really recommend that have that be a separate way to assess clients. And I could see there being a lot of value in both directions for that. So just a little laundry list of questions ranging from what is spiritual? Get into their definition. How do you incorporate religion, spirituality into your lives? And the three lower points for there are ones that are, of course, the lifeblood of our work. Let the process be. As the students who are in the room with us know, Irv Yalom, what does he say heals? It is the relationship that heals. And so rapport establishment is certainly the first element, but it's always ongoing in that process. Gradually over time, and try to phrase the questions to where they match the presenting problem, because clients may not have the faintest idea that there's going to be a spirituality element to their work with you, but they do know that something made them say, ouch, and that's what brought them to you somehow, some way. So this, I really was appreciative of their work with this because it is trying to get a mindset of where clients are, which could be very specific to religion, spirituality, but also just their experience with whatever the presenting problem is in their lives. And you can see the overlay where specifically religion, spirituality issues could be part of that. But depending upon how they're making meaning of their lives, So how many times have we had experiences where we hear from our clients to where something has happened and they look at life through a different set of lenses and they're really excited about that. As the process goes on, really get a sense as to who I am amidst this new way of life, seeking answers, questions about God with the separation, and what you see in parentheses with number three, often around 18 to 25 years old, once again is what I saw a lot in the literature. Perhaps that explains the line that was a few slides ago of we're spiritual but not religious. Age group of, you know, I know what my grandfather's and my parents' experiences were, but I'm going to branch out. I'm going to think about who I am, spread my own wings, if you will. And then as it goes on from not only spreading their wings, but following what they believe, despite the fact that, yeah, they recognize they have naturally human limitations, but I'm intrigued by number five. Whether it's desert times, there are big speed bumps in life. What is going on? I felt empowered, felt free, really felt who I am. And then an ugly or two or three comes into my life. And now, what is up? It's almost as though I have to rethink things. But the process goes on and kind of getting comfortable again with that process. And the article that we'll look at later this morning, Suffering and the Process of Transformation, touches on some of these concepts as well. Alrighty. Mindsets that all authors really encourage us to have, and that is to really appreciate the strength-based aspect for our clients, to really tap into that, to understand spirituality is to understand our clients' worldview. Again, how they are making meaning of life as they are fitting in with that. So the more successful, if I can use that word, the more successful we are with conducting a spiritual assessment, the more we understand how our clients are looking at the world. And when we can step into the client's world as much as possible, then we can really work with them to enhance the healing process that we all live for with our work. So there, as you see, the value that I know I see, hopefully you'll be able to see as well with the spiritual assessment tools that we'll look at in just a moment, is that many are very client-driven. They not only tap into the strengths that our clients have, but they get to chart the course for us. They get to have the lead, and we are not trying to dictate, to judge, to advocate our place, but rather to understand their roles for that. And, of course, it is very much an essential part of our lives as social workers, the cultural competence and social diversity with the code. It's very, very thorough in talking about how we in our world need to appreciate, be sensitive to diversity of many different categories, including clients' religious experience, understanding, and so forth. So we're done with the potpourri of thinking now, and these are the five examples that we will look at. Again, Dr. David Hodge is a very almost prolific writer of this aspect, and many people cite his work. He's written several different articles addressing how to incorporate these, and so hopefully you will also be able to appreciate. The one thing that I want to mention is that in your packets you will have not only samples to follow along, but you'll notice on the slides there will be an invitation for you to create your own. Certainly go with your comfort zone for all these. If you don't choose to participate in that level, no problem at all, but certainly an invitation to do that. So these are the five. And this is just a bit of an introduction to thinking about these specific spiritual tools. And so my question, want to check with you. The authors over and over that I read said social workers aren't really receiving a lot of training to conduct spiritual assessments. Does anyone have an experience you want to share? Have any of you had the formal training and so forth and so on? Okay. It's not a surprise, and I'm not sure exactly all the explanations behind that, but what I can say is the training that I had at Adler, that class was still considered an elective, an advanced diversity elective, so students could choose or not to choose that. So it's almost a contrast of, it's an important element of clients' lives, but we're not getting trained to help tap into to really strengthen our understanding and connection with clients along those ways. So another question that I have for you all is, are there clients, populations, that as you think about your own work, yeah, I could see incorporating spiritual assessment as important in my work with them? Anyone have thoughts on that? Yeah, see some heads nodding. Anyone want to volunteer, population? Any thoughts on that? Yeah, go for it.
I believe that there are many black homeless people who have a spiritual background, particularly that population.
Okay, certainly. And in fact, that's definitely reflected in the literature as well. Absolutely, yeah. Any others? Yeah.
I think just to go along with that, like the homeless in general, I work at a homeless shelter, and there's so much going on during that time in terms of, we were talking about the stages in that desert period, you know, that, like it kind of hit rock bottom.
Absolutely.
Or looking for that meaning and that purpose and to rebuild and redo. So definitely with that homeless population.
Thank you. And your first name?
Emily.
Emily. Thank you,
Emily. Any others? Any others? I know, you know, as I've mentioned, my motivation, inspiration for this talk is a lot of work with addiction, specifically adult children of alcoholic families. My premise behind exploring that was the fact that alcoholic family system, there's so many aspects of power and control about not being able to trust, because alcoholic parent, some days a yes means yes, other days, a yes means no, unpredictability. And so many times, those individuals turn into themselves. They chart their own course because they have not determined that people are really trustworthy. And so, well, if the people who are assigned to be caregivers, unconditional love providers, and so forth, and so, if they are not trustworthy, don't tell me that there's this force I can't see that is going to be trustworthy as well. So turning into themselves would make a bit more difficult to embrace and embolden their own spiritual search. Quantitative and qualitative approaches. Most of our tools that we have, we're going to be focusing on the qualitative. In fact, most people who write will say that to get the really rich experience of our clients, we need to be qualitative. Hear from the clients, hear their stories, spend time. We'll be a little bit of a guide, as you'll see with these tools and some questions, but when they're very client-driven, client-story-driven, qualitative, their world comes through. Quantitative, we have just a little bit. In fact, in your packet, you will find one of them. It's the very last line, the spiritual well-being scale. That was the measure that I used for my dissertation. Dr. Ray Palautsian was kind enough to let me share that with you. In fact, just fun story. When I first approached him, well, actually, I didn't even approach him. When I first put in a request to use the spiritual well-being scale for my dissertation, I came home and told my wife, not only did I get permission, but the man who created it wrote me personally. And we were both quite amazed. And then, you know, that was years ago. And then when I wrote again to not him, but the company, he wrote me again saying, and of course, I'll take him at his word. He said he remembered me, It's nice to think anyway. Yeah. Oh, gracious. But I shared with him after he wrote me, I shared with him how impressed we were and the look on my wife's face. And then he wrote back and said, "Tell your wife I think she's cool." And so I told Cindy that, and she looked at me, shrugged her shoulders, and said, "I know." So there we go. Oh, gracious sakes. I did not get permission to share that story, so I'm in trouble. Another element that you have in your packet is one that certainly can be used for sure with the first of the five. It's the spiritual histories. But at the same time, the questions can be certainly applied to all of the five spiritual assessment tools that you have. So as you look at that, you'll notice on the top part, there are questions that, I'm not using their words, but sort of softballing it. It gets the stage, is dipping your toes into the water, getting to know the topic, and then the lower half where you see it's called the interpretive anthropological framework. While the questions are suggestions, they're ones that feel free to use as inspiration as your guide. But some of the words, the communion, the conscience, they're words that, in fact, you see, Watchman Nee is his name, and going back nearly 50 years ago, really thought about human spirit as comprised, as you see, the three elements, the communion, conscious, and intuition. So there's a little bit of definition on the framework for conducting spiritual assessments that you have. Again, use those as a guide. Hopefully they will give you vocabulary as you think about the clients that you either are currently working with or certainly clients that you will be working with down the road. Hodge also mentioned that as much as there can be a lot of value with specific traditional vocabulary, there are times that either our spidey sense tingles that, no, I don't believe with this client I can use really formal, traditional, specific language, but I still suspect that there may be something important where we want to tap into the spiritual element of the clients. And so what we do is, as he calls it, conducting an implicit spiritual assessment. So in other words, something about what you're hearing in the client's vocabulary that implies a recognition of transcendent, perhaps not God that's associated with organized religion, but the transcendent. And examples can range from, we hear a pattern of words where the client is talking about anything where it's perfect, I'm in awe of, and so forth and so on. You hear words where, like polarities, it's either this or this, that, it's great or it's terrible. What Hodge says is that if we hear a persistent pattern of experiences from our clients using that sort of vocabulary, that may be a way that says there's something that's beyond the client that he or she is really appealing to understanding. And then we can start to use words that guide our process for that. So again, it's not using the traditional spiritual vocabulary, but the second little arrowhead point there, the sacred is a connection with seemingly secular activities. And is there any example that comes to your mind where someone might feel really a strong connection that we would put in the category of secular? I know there's one that comes to my mind. I've talked with many individuals who I believe would fit well with implicit. Those are individuals who are... Yes?
How about the religious holiday of the Super Bowl?
Yes. I hadn't thought about that one off the... Yes, but absolutely. And I've actually heard that there's been some talk, probably tongue-in-cheek, but to have the day after be a national holiday, yeah, I'm sure it has a lot to do with how they're feeling if their team lost. But, yeah, absolutely. Any others?
Yeah. Maybe just like people
say in their spiritual life, they feel a sense from you, like, by, like, oh, I think we'll work well together because I feel it from you, or I feel that we have this connection, or auras or colors.
There you go.
That was the word that came to my mind, the auras, yeah. The individual, any others? Any others? I know the individuals with whom I've spoken where I really sense this a lot is with nature. Get them out of the house, let them hike, birdwatch, any aspect. They feel a sense of connection that's beyond, it's certainly separate from organized religion. But those are the kinds of things where we can perhaps maybe never use traditional religious or spiritual vocabulary, but to tap into the client's experience. Again, the client's worldview is the driving force behind these all. All right. So finally, here we are after all that introduction. The first of our spiritual histories, and the spiritual histories are, and Hodge writes about this a lot, and that is they are very similar to conducting any kind of a history that you would have, a person's family, multigenerational history, and so forth. And so this is where what I was mentioning a little bit ago, that sometimes you can have a lot of success overlaying spiritual assessment questions on top of your assessment that you're conducting. And sometimes you do that separately. But the spiritual histories will have not only question and answer, but also they can have some of those quantitative type measures as well. So the ordering of the questions, and so you can certainly, as you see the bottom line, the framework conducting spiritual assessment is one area where you can incorporate that. It keeps it more of a loosely structured, but still a structured clinical interview along with that. So you see some of the questions to guide them from what is their religious affiliation, if any, and so forth and so on. Any questions, comments so far about anything? Okay. So this is where some of the quantitative, quasi-qualitative assessments come from, that spiritual histories can include sentence completion exercises, and I don't have the full list up there, but I know when I do psych testing, sentence completion exercises are a wonderful tool that draws information out from people. It's not a pure qualitative because we've given some words to them. We've given them categories, and we want them to respond within the bounds of that. I think the spiritual, let them fill in the blank. Thinking about my past, notice where that can really tap into the implicit spiritual assessment. I know that the students here who take human behavior in the social environment will look at Fowler's stages of religious development, and that's a little picture of that where from just having no faith at all to where you kind of understand it but you don't have a vocabulary, working way down to universalizing faith. The one question that people have, they always have with anything that's really quantitative as a measure, is that somebody has to interpret it. In other words, oh, you're telling me this story, I believe you. I would plot you here on the chart. And does that mean that you're not quite fully functioning spiritual? And just as important, and is something that everybody cautions us about, is to try to avoid a deficit mindset. That there's still some problems with you, you're not quite there, there's a little something wrong, and so forth. So while the spiritual histories can incorporate some quantitative-like measures, they can have some of their drawbacks, if you will. Yeah. Cindy. Yeah, they are pretty far away. Yeah, even with the handout. Yeah, the very top one where you're just getting ready to hop in the boat. Stage zero, infancy or undifferentiated faith. There's nothing really distinct that's guiding you. You're not associated, affiliated with church or with people. You don't have a vocabulary. Stage one is the intuitive, projective faith. you're getting a sense from other individuals, you may be picking up clues around. Stage two, mythic, lyrical faith, from storybook to any powers that would be seen beyond you. Three, synthetic, conventional faith. You understand the rules, if you will, the steps that go into the process. The fourth, individuative, reflective faith. Some of these might sound a bit familiar to Oaks and Raffel's stages of spiritual growth as well. Individuative, reflective faith says, I know what I've been raised with, but I'm starting to see what that means to me, and what it means to me might be different from what I've been raised with. Conjunctive faith is the fifth one, and then the last one is universalizing faith. The concepts are somewhat similar to Maslow's self-actualizing. You're finding who you are with your faith experience, and you're extremely comfortable with that. Okay. Any other questions, comments for that? All righty, going to move on. And so I've already shared some of these, the advantages, disadvantages for those. Do any of you have some questions or comments where you think spiritual history of that nature can fit well, perhaps some disadvantages?
So, you were saying to overlay or to do it separately. And I think that it should be something that's overlaid, doing that separate, because a person's beliefs and values, in my diversity class, we talked about cultural competence. We talked about people with a certain set of values and beliefs. You know, like in the Asian community, for one, it's like a dishonor for like the women. So they're less likely to report like abuse, things like that.
Sure, sure.
So understanding those things, those values and those beliefs, I think are important in assessment, because it can help, you know, guide, you know, the counselor, the worker.
Thank you. And your first name?
Jermaine.
Thank you so much.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Thank you. Anyone else? Okay. The longer you're in the field, you know that there are going to be some clients where it'll just feel very comfortable for that. And so I appreciate that perspective, definitely. So spiritual life maps is when we definitely turn the corner to where very client-driven, very self-determination part. And so you have a handout, and you can tell which one it is because it's a very circuitous route that follows the sheet. And as you see on the slide, what are they? Is the client's spiritual experience in pictures. And on the table, there's blank sheets of paper, and we have crayons. And so there will be an opportunity for you just to play around writing your own. But what I really appreciated about it, and I do some of these with clients that I'm working with down at Onarga Academy, is let them chart their life. It can be from birth to where they're at now, or any particular important starting place along their lives. So we get to see where they come, where they are now, and perhaps what they anticipate down the road for themselves. So some advantages for that, and there are many for that. There is a greater emphasis on client autonomy because they get to determine where they want to call the starting place. And we follow their lead. The life map gives the basic structure, it gives an example, and they follow. One young man that I'm doing it with at Onarga, he has a rough past. He's been in multiple placements up till now. And so what I notice is that we revisit his map every few weeks or so, and there's a new memory of his life that comes back. Initially, he talked 2 points, and then he was done. We just bring it back and let him look at that, and I just ask the questions, give him some age groups and so forth, and we continue to add on, and some memories about his life are coming back. And so I love the idea that it jogs the memory, but he's in total control of what he wants. Of course, hopefully, the setting is always relaxed. It's the encouragement for us. So again, as you see, the map is the center of that. And I like the fact that Hodge words it like that, is that if clients, and some are, self-conscious about having the spotlight on them, we get to look at that object that's on the table. Yeah, we're collaborating, but that's the focus. And when that's the focus, the heat's off of them a bit, they feel more liberated and follow that trail from there. And clients' thoughts are objectified. The beautiful part that helps people like me is that you do not have to have any formal training with art. I'm married to a wonderful artist. I cannot draw a stick man straight with a ruler. And it just... So I like the fact that I can be me and be bad at the drawing part of that. But the abstract elements, because there's a little bit of description, sometimes a word, a picture, I have an opportunity to just look at the map and see the parts of me that have been made me hard to describe in other ways, that I now can see my life charted on that. Just some assurances for us. There isn't a correct way. The client's life, the client's story is the, quote, correct way. Whatever works. And it is really kind of fun to have the opportunity, whether it's collages or simple drawings with whatever items you have there. So as you take a look, and hopefully you've been able to find the life map picture that's on there. It's the life of Darren can come out, and I have just some notes that I scribbled about his life. But as you look at it, you can get a little bit of a sense just from that. So clients can identify the strengths as well as the trials in their life, symbolized by whatever pictures, drawings, and so forth that they have on there. The life map that you have, Darren, when he was 29 years old, so notice he doesn't start his life map in his infancy, but he starts it at 29 years old. He had an incredibly powerful spiritual awakening, and he joined a Pentecostal church and was on fire for that. But when he was in his 20s, he had a stormy dating relationship, and he was getting into a lifestyle that was not healthy for him. He was an only child in a two-parent household prior to his spiritual awakening. He was very active with sports. He always looked at life as having caring, supportive, comfortable relationships. But in his early 20s, his life just seemed to be unraveling. Dating relationships that he had were not fulfilling. They were argumentative. And then, never any specifics, but he got into a pattern in his life where things were not healthy for him. And so that's when, in his late 20s, he joined the church and had that profound spiritual awakening. But during that time, he was fired from his job. So he had a low point, but because he was with his church family, they supported him through that and got through it with really not a sense that he was too terribly lost. In his early 30s, his parents died, and that really rocked his world a lot. And so it's because of that experience he started to have his religious and spiritual life start to feel shaky. He was in, as you see on the life map, in his dark time of his soul, if you will. And as that went, was crying out to God, what is going on? He's eventually able to marry and feels a renewed sense. So you see that little bit of a story on his life map. Is there anything else on Darren's life map that stands out to you? You have questions or comments about? Thank you. I'm going to move on to the next slide. Okay. So these are some questions that you can ask, but also areas that you can tap in to try to better understand. From, as you see in the left-hand column, just one of the four categories of questions, and these are just some samples, relationship with God, a transcendent being. How have you felt supported? Then we look on the right-hand column. You know, when you think about it, how would Darren respond to, in a spiritual sense, what is going on with his stormy dating relationships in his early 20s? Where was God? What is my belief system when I was fired? About when his parents died? And all these questions that we can see fitting in there, rituals to help him cope. Certainly when he was fired from his job, he was very tied with the Pentecostal church, and spiritual mentors in your life. So these are categories of questions that can guide the process. Clients can add on information from there. Okay. Any questions or comments for that? Okay. More information, again, just to guide your thinking, guide your question asking for them. Just ways to think about our clients. We are meaning makers, as you see with number one. One of the other benefits, of course, is that, and this pops up a lot in the literature as I was reading, some ways that spiritual assessments can really be enhanced is, as you're talking with individuals, the cognitive behavioral aspects can be part of the healing process. Clients can take a look at their life map, and with your guidance, get a sense of challenging any unhealthy beliefs. They may challenge themselves to recognize all this process. It now has meaning, whereas before it seemed to be just maybe one ugly after another ugly and can't put it all together. Okay. Any questions, or as you're looking at these, are there any client situations that are coming to your mind where you can see that they can fit? And so we've looked at Darren's life map. I invite you, we'll spend just a few moments, if you'd like. There's a sheet of paper and some things to write with. Feel free, if you'd like. Take a few moments and construct your own life map. Again, very few rules. All right. I'm going to go ahead and get started again. Hopefully you were able to at least get a sense as to how this can work. I know for me, in my work, the more I'm familiar with the tools, the more I have self-awareness, the more that I can, have a deeper appreciation of what the process is like as I work with my clients as well. So we're going to shift gears to the next one, which are spiritual eco-maps. And some of you, maybe all of you, are familiar with the structure of eco-maps. And one of the things that's distinct about eco-maps is that they are very here and now focused, looking at the relationship of the client with his or her other relationships, whether they are family or other systems around them. So when you look in your package, you will see an example of a spiritual eco-map to look at its structure. And there's a bit of a story. So I'm just going to go through some of these rather quickly, but one of the things that is clearly a benefit is that there are some individuals, as you see that the next to last point, solid supplements to genograms. Well, sometimes the benefit for an eco map compared to any other type of style is that it does not require or request the client go into the past. there's some individuals who are, if not hesitant, perhaps outright skeptical that going back into the past is going to have anything to do with my current functioning. So spiritual ecomap lets us take a look at the right here and right now. In fact, I was reading another article referencing these ecomaps and said that there was a family that it was one of those rough situations where a child needed to be removed from the household. They were working with the parents, and as soon as they were able to put an ecomap and keep the focus on the systems, the parents warmed to the idea of getting help because they could start to plot the systems that were both in their lives right now as well as potential for systems of support. Had there been another approach, according to this author, of looking in the past for, let's say, a history of parenting styles, they might have gotten rather defensive for that. So they shifted the focus outside of themselves, and they were able to have success with that. There's no, again, rule of thumb for this, but these are some things that Hodge says can really enhance your spiritual ecomap. And you'll notice in the example that you have in the packet that there are some lines and symbols that demonstrate that. The thicker ones not only show the strength of the relationship, but you notice the distinction about which way the arrows are pointed. That's another very, very powerful, very practical aspect of ecomaps, is that you can look at which way the energy in that relationship is going. I know in our work with our clients, there seem to be times we are really pouring ourselves into them. We may not feel like we're getting much back. Sometimes clients will say that they are pouring themselves into another system, another relationship, but not getting necessarily back. Sometimes also it's a two-way street, and so there's different ways to play around with that. They're all symbolic. So that on one sheet, one page, one drawing, you get to see a very powerful story that's going on with the clients. Next slide. These next two slides are types of categories of questions that can guide you as you're both constructing as well as discussing the ecomaps. And these aren't in any particular order of importance, although many times authors have said that starting with rituals is often a comfort level for the clients because it's what they do, it's what they practice with. And then the other questions have them more shine the flashlight on themselves, more of the experience aspect for that. One of the things is that you notice on the example of yours is that in the drawing of the symbols of the systems outside the client system, the God transcendent is above to symbolize its preeminence, the potential, and then notice where rituals are. On the lower half, to act as a foundation for that. Move on to the next. Again, more questions that can help guide, in the construction or the discussion of spiritual leaders can certainly be, and there are stories, many that can talk about the pastors, the ministers, the priests in the church family, but also the idea that there can be spiritual mentors, and perhaps many of you in this room do have or have had individuals who've spoken to your life, and they were not necessarily members of the clergy, but they were very important people that would occupy a place on your specific ecomap. And how do we apply them? Just a little bit about the story that you are seeing. All the members of the family are part of an evangelical church, and that's how they see an important source of strength is their involvement with the church. This family has many, many rituals that they observe on a regular basis from family prayer time, have Bible story reading, as well as regular church attendance. The husband had a strong dislike of his parents' religious background, and because it was a strongly Protestant background, and thought it was very rule-oriented. The wife in the family, she was raised in a secular home, and one of the things that's powerful, as you look at the picture of that ecomap, you notice to the right of that family, you see she had a previous relationship. She had a daughter from that first union. The daughter died. And one of the powerful aspects, which goes back to the anthropological framework where the three aspects of spirit included the communion as well as the conscience. She had a premonition about her daughter's death. And you know, so that was very moving for her, no doubt about it. But that experience for her inspired her in a more profound way to engage in a spiritual search, meaning for life. And you'll see that storyline pop up again when we look at the article that you have in your packet. But through her spiritual search, got tied with the church where she has poured herself in, she experiences it as such a powerful source of strength. It literally nourishes her soul. Okay. So those are some of the stories. Just for the sake of time, I will bypass you constructing your own ecomaps, but certainly perhaps at breaks, feel free to do that. But the spiritual ecomaps, among everything else, probably the greatest application is to be able to look at the very here and now. And I know when I construct them with my clients, for me, one of the most important parts is when the clients start to draw arrows to and from. Sometimes I've had clients come back to me the next session because I gave them the homework to work on their own ecomap with the emphasis on the arrows and direction of energy. They came back and they said, "No wonder I'm so tired. I'm given to my kids, I'm given to my job, and what kind of thanks do I get?" And then they give me the, "Yeah, you're right, Barry, I don't get no thanks." And so we really get to see where their story is very here and now. It might or might not parlay into discussions about family of origin, and that's absolutely fine. The next is, again, the very opposite in many ways, the focus, the spiritual genogram that you see. Those of you who are, and I give a shout-out to my Practice 2 students, social workers, who are in the room today. In about a month from now, you'll be getting very invested in understanding the elements of conducting a family assessment. And so you will be introduced to genograms. So if you haven't already, this is your introduction to them. So for those of you who are in the field and are familiar with them, what do you like about the use of genograms in your work?
They're more fun than reading a narrative social history.
Absolutely.
And they tell just about as much or more.
You betcha. Absolutely love it for that. Yes?
Well, and for people who are more visual, like they get to see patterns and connections and, you know, seeing like the family history, spiritual history, maybe abuse or substance abuse, like medical health, like all of those things, like it can be really powerful.
I agree. I think it just helps understanding the families in the day and age where there's so many half-siblings, step-siblings, step-moms, ex-step-moms, and you just get lost when they're trying to tell you all this. So, like, let's just take a break and draw it out. And it really helps, I think, everybody, and you can remember and pull it back out and look at it.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. Any others? I know. Before I came to the Kankakee area, I worked in Northwest Illinois at a community mental health center, and the office that I had was no windows and dark brown paneling all the way around. It was like I was living in a chunky candy bar. But the good thing about it is that I could get butcher block paper and put thumbtacks on, And it was especially fun for my tweenagers and teenagers. Just stand up and start drawing out the family, especially appreciate the blended family. Getting to map that all out, and 40 minutes just went by like that, because they're seeing and constructing. It was a lot more fun to sit there and talk to the old, well, I wasn't a bald guy then. Back in the day when I had hair and it was dark is when we would do that kind of thing. All righty. Any other experiences that you had, favorable or perhaps unfavorable? Okay. I know the one example that I mentioned that was, for many clients, an advantage to the EcoMaps is that for the clients who are a bit hesitant, they just don't want to or they don't believe going back into the past is of value to them, genograms may not be the path to go, at least not now. May find creative ways to introduce that with them. But the one thing, and this is just a true confession on my part, I had a client who was pouring out her story, and I was diligently drawing her genogram, except I didn't tell her that I was drawing her genogram. You know what she thought I was doing, right? She thought I was doodling while she was pouring out her soul. Note to self, moving right along. Some of the many potential advantages, benefits of the genograms is as you map out the multi-generational, as we know, solid genograms, the recommendation is minimum 3 generations to be able to look at patterns. And some of the aspects of spirituality experiences, you look at the multi-generational transmission of, in this case, practices, beliefs, important elements of a spiritual lifestyle. So some ways how this gets passed on is when grandparents are living with their adult children and their grandchildren. The stories, the rich heritage is right there in that dwelling. Also, children, grandchildren can be influenced by the stories, whether or not they are living in the same household. And another part that I found interesting in the literature is that the gender element is that when looking at just story after story, case after case, the females in the households tend to be much more dedicated at passing on the faith, sharing the stories to keep that alive. So those are powerful aspects that as you look at the genogram, circles are females, squares are males, and I know it took me a long time to stop presenting the fact that all guys are squares, but there we go. So as you see here, this is just some of the basics, and you already have a sample to where you can see the makeup for that. The copies don't do justice to what an actual genogram could look like. I don't go into the same detail that Hodge does, but I can appreciate where he's coming from, so I just don't go into the detail. But what he really says can be extremely powerful, and I agree with him, is that, again, you know, going off what you mentioned, Caleb, with the multiple families, blendings, and experiences, there can be different religious affiliations and reactions to those religious affiliations that you see multiple generations, and so you can color code them and have a key and little notes along the side, and you can have a genogram, spiritual, just pops right out, and it demands, tell me the story on this whole aspect that's going on. Alrighty. So this is what I was just mentioning. You can have all sorts of creativity, as you see on the genogram sample, little words, phrases. There are some rules that you see, symbols that are universal to the process of the construction of genograms. But one of the things that Hodge and many others indicate is that there can be some value to incorporate people who are not part of the family but are still very influential in your spiritual life, and you give them the designation of a triangle. They may not have been blood relation or by law related, but they served an extremely important role in the person's development. So some questions, just some of many, to guide as you're exploring it with your clients. Talk about the affiliations, multi-generational. And how do people express their beliefs? Questions that can go on. Talk about a ritual, faith, coping. What kinds of practices do you put into place during the times of uglies? And goodness knows, all of us have trials, demands, dark times, desert times. So some of many questions, and depending upon how traditional the vocabulary is with religion, spirituality, the content can be of one kind. If it's more of an implicit spiritual assessment, certainly follow another route. But all the questions, all the samples that we've seen up till now, from the framework to what we saw with Oakes and Raphael, all ways to get us to be thinking about questions, comments, categories to draw out clients. It's just different ways to guide our understanding of their experience. Still more questions, and as you see, there are a lot of them because you can have a lot of players involved with that. The third point down, what religious and spiritual patterns stand out about your family? As you're all done with it, you take a big step back, and then it's always one of my favorite things to just watch their eyes of all the things that stand out to them. Follow their lead. More questions. What if an experience of one individual is profoundly different from another? A couple of displays, differing levels of religious and spiritual involvement. I've worked with many a couple to where one individual wants to be and already is actively involved with religious traditions. Partner does not share that. And the challenges run deep in many ways, the discussions, whether they're together in the room or just one of them in the room with me. Spiritually devout grandparent wishes to pass along devotion to grandkids. What if the parents of those children do not share that? So again, not necessarily giving you answers, but it certainly helps us understand what are some questions that we need to ask, because that can certainly, among other things, guide how we introduce therapeutic interventions into the process. Are there any questions, comments about anything of that nature up till now? Okay. But I tell students, and I think this myself in my practice, when in doubt, ask more questions. Make fewer declarative statements. And no matter the nature of the question, it draws clients out more, and it keeps us nimble trying to figure out. So these, again, are still more what-ifs. I'm going to just move on for that. Again, for the sake of time, I'll just be very, very brief with Marx. And those of you who have been in class with me this semester will appreciate my typo. You see, there's the example of Mark and Beth. I typed and I didn't catch it until just the other day. I had it down Mark and Betty. All right, yeah. Oh, I've really been influenced by that, haven't I? So as you look at the genogram, what aspects of the story stand out to you? I'll just give you a moment, and then aspects that stand out to you, just shout them out to me.
I could be completely wrong, but doesn't the line between David and Stacy say that there's like a strained relationship?
Yes, absolutely. And the easiest comparison I make is that it can look like a lightning bolt. Charge. A little bit of trouble in River City here. Yep. Okay.
Anything? Can you explain what the different backgrounds, like the ones are dotted, ones are dashed?
Yeah, and this doesn't give a good description for that. There's a dotted color coding, and it's really specific to the family to distinguish things. Mark's family, single denominational affiliation, specifically Southern Baptist. So that's a symbol for that. That doesn't come through very well in a photocopy. So those different things represent different denominations, et cetera. Yeah, Mike?
I think the most remarkable thing about this genogram is that the marriage itself between Mark and Beth is really struggling and going to continue to struggle because there's affiliations that are totally separate there. They don't share a single child between the two of them. And so they're in a situation where they're trying to put together two entities, and our one entity themselves is very weak and probably still with both feet in each separate entity.
Yeah, good point. Absolutely. Absolutely. Anything else? The fact that Beth has a very diverse religious affiliation background, Mark is distinct with one. There can sometimes be the ideas of which one is right, which one is wrong, which will we choose, what are the influences that we allow, that we won't allow, and so forth and so on. Anything else from that that stands out?
One last thing.
Sure.
You know, this is just me and my suspicious mind, but it looks to me like the youth pastor might have a little different relationship with Beth than he might be hitting on. I'm a little worried about that.
Absolutely. Yep, you're absolutely right. Absolutely right. Yep, you bet. Anything else stand out to you? Yep, they always are stories. Yes, Jermaine.
Does it seem like that her background is like really just rich? Like you talk about those mentorships.
Sure.
And when you look at Mark, you don't see like those.
She could be
relationships.
And it is kind of an odd contrast that Mark, having such a strong background with one denomination, it didn't seem to branch out to other areas. Whereas hers, with diversity, it almost seems like it would be too watered down, but it's just the opposite. Yeah. Okay. Anything else stand out to you about that? I will have to look. I don't have that. Yeah. Yeah, Ruth, her youth pastor, has significant experience, yeah. 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 There isn't any reference to that, but it's always a good question to ask. Oh. Yeah. Yeah. It's a strong spiritual, and there was a experience where are you looking at Carol specifically? Yeah. Carol had a premonition about a dream that said a member's going to be okay, they're in heaven, but they're okay. And so that symbolizes a strong spiritual connection along those lines. Yeah. All righty. Anything else with that? So again, for the sake of time, I'll invite you, as you desire, to create your own spiritual genogram. The last one is one that I've got to confess, Dr. David Hodge introduced me to this name. I was not familiar with it until last year. An ecogram. And as you see it, it is a blend of both the ecomap and a genogram. So when you get comfortable with the structure of those two as separate ways, then you find a way to blend them. And you talk about a rich kind of story. Very powerful for that. And just, again, for the sake of time, I'll just go through these a little bit. So this is just the structure of the ecograms. And I'm hoping to find a little bit on Karen's story, because she's the identified client in this family system. So as you see, some ways very consistent with the ways we've been able to have interventions, ways to think about interpreting, analyzing, understanding in our assessment, is that just like as you've mentioned with both the ecomaps and the genogram separately, you draw this one map, ecogram, and Klein gets to see both history and current, very rich story about that, and adopt new narratives. It's something which I think is just so true about us human beings is that we're not only meaning makers, but we are so story-bound. In fact, there's many, many articles, chapters, and books that I've read is that one way that we remember is through narrative. We have a story that goes on in our mind, and that becomes, of course, that's ours. It's vitally important for us. And so as we see past and present unified, as this suggests, we can add a new narrative, a new way to tell a story for that. Okay. So possible interventions for that. Especially what I like about it is that for your current and past, you can look at patterns where other family members have had strong rituals, traditions that help them through adversity. How can that apply to your current situation of adversity trial that you have right now? Okay. So even more interventions, as you see, there are several for that. So I'm going to just move on to the next slide. So Karen, her ecogram, I'll just read a little bit from this. Karen's father's side, Roman Catholic, and there's only one exception, maternal grandmother, left Methodist affiliation for Catholicism. Karen's mom died. Her name was Kate at the age of 52. Kate experienced a tremendous, strong outpouring of God's love when she was in her 30s. So you see the symbol of the heart and the dove. Kate left her traditional Catholic church, started going to a charismatic Catholic church. Her brother Carl had a spiritual awakening when he was at a camp at the age of 14. He eventually went on to another church. One of the powerful parts, which could again be rich for story as well as ripe, you know, for intervention, Karen's father, Harry, and her sister, Rachel, they're not particularly devout, but what they do believe in is that you stay with the church. And so her decision to go another direction led to some tension in their relationship. So it was very spiritual focus. Same dialogue, same vocabulary, but different experience about that influenced some family tension along the ways. Okay. Is there anything else about the ecogram that you see that stands out to you, one way or the other? All righty. So we're going to take a break in just a moment, but leave this opportunity. Are there questions, any aspects that stand out to you? Is there one of these five that you are particularly drawn to, you find would be helpful? Yes, Marcia.
I was just kind of saying my table here, maybe for those who, like myself, are not, you know, great artists, you know those little circle sticker post-it things, you know, that you use on files or whatever?
Oh, sure.
Could use those or maybe other stickers for some of the pictures, and that might be better for maybe youth or, you know, maybe.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Love the creativity. And you can get them for probably not too much money at a local office supply store. Yeah, you bet. Okay. Anything else stand out to you? All righty. Folks, take a well-deserved break, and we will come back, and we'll watch a video. That's what the cover looks like. And so that's just, again, the history that I gave you before. But now that you've seen that, you can go in any order, but what elements of Neil's story stood out to you?
Well,
change that he experienced, like in his teen years, like right in the university?
Yeah. Something, nervous, I forget the term that he used. I had never heard that phrase before in this video, but a nervous experience, which we know in the field, if it's schizophrenia-like, often hits in the college years. So it would be consistent with that. We don't have much other information, but that does stand out. Yeah. How about others? What stood out about Neil?
Maybe that despite all his hardship, he kept striving to try and do something to make a difference. Like, he didn't even want to sit in his living room for an hour because he wanted to be out there doing something.
And that's the part that would not be all that necessarily consistent with a traditional schizophrenia, as we see. He wants to be with people, engaging with them, and having responsible positions. Yeah. Other things that stand out. Yes, ma'am.
He wanted to help others, but wasn't willing to accept.
You've introduced yourself. I've forgotten your first name.
Felicia.
Felicia, yeah, thank you. Yeah, isn't that interesting? Isn't that interesting? Yeah. What other observations?
He was, like, defensive about his relationships. And he was like, I've never walked out of a relationship. And it takes two. Like, it seemed like he was really defensive about it.
Yeah. You read between the lines that he assumed he was pouring himself into them. But something happened that inspired the other person to turn around and go the other way. Yeah. Other things? Yes, Mike.
He has a deep hurt that no one in this room could tell us what it really is, and he wasn't willing to reveal it. You could see he'd been deeply hurt, probably more than once, somehow. And that to me is a root issue that would be very interesting to deal with over time in counseling.
Good point. And that is an excellent way to ask, if you were to apply one or maybe more than one of the tools that we looked at, which one stands out to you? Where would you like to start if you were to work with him and use one of those five? Yeah.
Start with the genogram issue.
Okay.
Yeah. What happened in the family?
Continue to map that out, multi-generational. He certainly doesn't even hint. He talks about how the genetic aspect would have a strong influence on any children, so that, you know, certainly said, I'm not sure how many more generations of Neils I want. Yeah. Emma?
I was going to kind of say the opposite, where he seems very defensive and uncertain about talking about his past, so like wanting to go directly to that hurt might be something he's not willing to do and a little bit resistant, so like building trust, I might do the eco map, where I can be more present focused and kind of get to build his trust and rapport and things like that, and then potentially then do more of like a genogram when I have that trust and he's willing to go a little bit deeper with me.
So maybe eventually evolve into an ecogram as it would evolve, sure. When you think about an eco map for Neil, what systems would you put in place, irrespective of whether you'd have God transcendent at the top, rituals at the bottom? What aspects, what systems would be significant players in his life? A question that people ask me all the time, and I don't have the answer for it. If you were to watch several of these series, you'd hear certain of the adults mention that they're not exactly sure how come they're willing to do it another time. There were a few that just dropped out in their 20s, never to be heard from again. Some, and Neil is not alone, many individuals say that when people tune in, when it's time to watch the next Up series, they think they're really getting to know me. The camera crews are with these people for a few hours, and then you see you had, what, 13, 14 minutes of Neil. And he says that people see the show right into him. I know what it's like to be. Well, I'm not so sure you do. So people ask the question, what keeps him coming back? Because it doesn't, I've never picked up that it's a strong financial incentive. And it does say, here I am, world. Somebody named Michael's going to keep asking me questions, as you saw with Neil, at times deeply personal questions. And so we don't have the answer exactly for that, but something has kept Neil comfortable enough to let England see him for another few minutes every 7 years. Okay. So if you were to sit down with Neil and ask him some questions, as you watched him, did you have any spinning around? How about when we overlay spirituality? What kinds of questions would you like to ask Neil related to his spiritual experience? He was a lay clergy person. And it's, of course, not accidental editing that they go back into his 20s. I'm not sure I believe in God. Another of one of those poignant profile questions, was it 42 up? Questioning about God, what do you think about him now? Neil was in one of those low periods of life. Physically, he looked haggard, living a homeless life. Question, what's your relationship with the transcendent being right now? And the look on his face, as well as the tone of his voice, said that he was in one of those dark times. So what has happened in those years to where now any doubts that he had been replaced by a willingness to serve? And we hear a completely different tone in his voice. I get to do about everything that a formal clergy can do, leading services, has the garb, leading, giving sermons. So question that I would love to ask is, what happened? Was it a transformational moment? He's clearly well-read. Was it some philosophical perspective that he encountered that gave him the freedom to look another way? Don't know. Don't know. Anyone else? Yes, Erica. Oh. You know what? I think probably at this point he would consider himself very differentiated, that he, because of all of his life experiences, he believes he is who he is right now. I think that's where he would have comfort level, even though I agree with what you're mentioning, Mike, all the deep pain. I don't think that he's quite at peace with some aspects of his life. And so that might, if you really pressed him, might be difficulty to get him to reconcile the uglies that he's had in his life with where he's occurring right now. Yeah. Yeah, Justin.
I think it'd be interesting to do a spiritual life map with him because he might be more open to drawing it out. And even though, like, you can see where changes took place in his life, even though he might not tell you what it is.
Yeah. And who knows what kinds of symbols he would use to draw, if any. But as we've seen so many times, when we have the work completed, we can take some steps back and then start to see patterns, alter the narrative, give a new perspective for things. Who knows what that would be like for a person like Neil? He knows what he knows, and he's comfortable, and he's been his own man in some ways. You saw, and they, again, they were very intentional to go back in the past, looking at his times of homelessness or living in really substandard conditions, dirty, very little to go on, access to hygiene, not real common. But he was okay with that. For people who weren't okay, they wouldn't have allowed cameras in there. But sure, follow me in. Yeah, you can watch me wash my hands in the bathtub. It's okay. So it's an interesting path. Of all the video clips that I could have shown when I've watched Neil, I thought, yeah, that would be one that would be hopefully pretty consistent, because we don't know what kind of presenting problem Neil would ever bring. Neil might be a fellow that would never darken our doors. What, you know, to kind of borrow from Alfred E. Newman, what, me worry? But there's something that we can learn from, and hopefully Neil would be able to learn as well and come to peace with any aspects, like you say, Mike, the hurts, the pains that have been going on. anything else related to Neil. Okay. Now, have you take another pause. You have in your packet the essay by Deborah Barrett. And again, I give you the page numbers from the beginning, 461 to 463, up to the dimensions of suffering, and then move on to the last section, 471, that begins with the heading, The Gifts of Suffering Through the End. Take a few moments, read that, and then we will come back. Well, have us come back together. Hopefully we're able to get, if not done, close to being done. But what elements of the pages that you read really stood out to you? What resonated with you?
Yes, please. I'm sorry, your first name?
Maria.
Maria.
The whole thing that stood out was that community suffering that you have to come together, that things can be hard to do, but it was chronic, that it's important because suffering is part of it. The other thing that stood out was the thing about the gifts of suffering was that with suffering, there can be a person can get an insight into maybe their own strengths that maybe they did not know they possess. They can gain purpose through suffering. And also, maybe a sense of being in something, a sense of their mortality, their situation.
Thank you. Well put. What other things stood out? Yeah, Justin?
One part you said, like, by avoiding suffering, we're doing the opposite of what we want. Becoming resistant to suffering.
Yeah. Thank you. I know on page 462, it'd be the second page in, halfway down, there's that block quotation where she's been talking what Justin was mentioning, that we, in the process of trying to barricade ourselves from, we end up being almost caught by surprise in that block quote. People who have assumed their exemption from pain, they're now drained by taking it on. And I wrote in the comments what it seemed to me is, I did everything right. How can I hurt? This whole process, instead of allowing it to be an aspect of reality, instead of segmented from us. Yes, Mike. Right.
Not something that's happening,
right.
But an entity.
Right.
That's one. The other one, just an aside perhaps, is suffering has a gender referred to as her.
Okay, sure.
I thought that was pretty interesting.
It is, well. Yeah. And I couldn't hazard an assumption as to what drove that, but she does talk about it being almost close to where you embrace it. It can be like a lover with whom you have a relationship with. We don't deny that. Yeah.
I'm going to tell my wife about it. I consider my wife to be a guiding thread, which she defines as what suffering is. And I don't want to imply
it. We can all sign waivers for confidentiality, right? Other things that stand out.
Yeah.
I thought it was cool how it talks about suffering helps you to have your eyes open more to see other people in a new way. You no longer see people just like people who are suffering. You don't necessarily just see their suffering. You see the person themselves.
Yeah.
It changes your point of view.
Thanks, Nora. Yes.
What stood out for me was that the importance of validation, and that, you know, true healing comes as we validate that.
Thank you.
Your first name?
Nancy. Thank you.
Did you have
sometimes, like, when things happen to us, you're like,
get mad at God. We're like, you know, God, why is this happening to me? Like you said, I did everything right. Like, why is this happening? But, like, not necessarily, like, suffering is, like, a gift, but it's, like, it's part of his way to, like, transform us, like, to make us into, like, this better person. So, I mean, it's hard when we're going through that thing to, like, realize it, but maybe it's, I mean, it's almost his way of, like, showing us how special we are. Like, I want you to experience this, you're going to get through it, and you're going to be, like, even more awesome when, you know, and have a different perspective once you go through it. So it's something we should embrace, which I wouldn't have thought.
A movie clip, which I didn't have time for, but a wonderful movie based on a segment of life of C.S. Lewis, and I know some students have seen it. It's called Shadowlands. And it's an interesting contrast. Well, you know, Anthony Hopkins was no longer a serial murderer. He was C.S. Lewis, which, good for him. But interestingly, talking about when he's giving presentations, he's talking about suffering and pain, but it's up here. It's like a chisel. God chisels us, and he wants us to grow up. And it's a discussion. It's a nice talking point. And then he falls in love, and he's a changed man, trying to get his legs under him about, this is new. And then his beloved Joy has incurable cancer. She's going to die. And then suffering. Yes, he understands that he's a smart, logical man, but he lives it. And my favorite line from that movie is, paraphrasing, I pray because I cannot help. Prayer doesn't change God, it changes me. And talk about when we go back to that first sheet of paper that you have, the framework for conducting a spiritual assessment. You look at the communion, the conscience, the intuitive, how they pop up in Deborah's story, especially that first page. That's some rough stuff. Lose a child, and many of you know that when a couple loses a child, that can be one of the most challenging aspects, can at times drive a wedge in a marriage. So they seek healing. And what happens? He runs off with the therapist. Child, second child born, autism, it's just one thing after the other, but she has that communion-like experience, which we've seen in other stories earlier. But in the very first page, in that last paragraph, in the very first page, she says, over time I began to wonder about that experience. It seemed to lead me into a new relationship with myself, with my God. Suffering seemed to result in healing and transformation. And then the next sentence I highlighted, after a few similar experiences, comma, and I didn't finish highlighting it, I wrote in the margin, I wonder what they were. She had more? My goodness. That's challenging stuff. But through that all, she felt all the intensity that would go with that suffering of aloneness and then aloneness and then aloneness, but continued to search, maybe at times fearfully, but then fearlessly, and is able to give us an essay of that. Poignant, philosophical, but I realized when I read this again yesterday, inspirational. Led us to think about the process, which is going to be the parts of our clients' lives over and over and over again. So it invites the questions again of what spiritual assessment tools, of all the different sorts of questions that we could ask, the menu, the categories, mindsets, to creep into the worldview of our clients, to understand that their spirituality, their understanding is a strength for them. Tapping into the vocabulary can be quite powerful. Is there anything else you wanted to comment on this? Yeah, Mike? Sure.
Can we stipulate that the therapist that her husband ran off with never came to an ethics workshop and all of that?
So I think that's a safe bet. My goodness, right? Yeah. Thank you. Anything else? Okay. So now we're shifting gears to the last aspect, and depending on time, I'll probably have to truncate some of this, but this is the outline. We'll get through what we can, but just a bit of history, because this is a population that I just about fell into. In my first job in the field, I was recruited to be one of the outpatient substance abuse program counselors. And it was quite the learning curve. I don't have addictions in my family background, so it was knowledge-based first and then relation-based, and it has been not the only but an important part of my profession for many years. So I'll give you a little bit of history leading up to what is now, hands down, the most successful, most effective self-help group on this planet. Alcoholics Anonymous, it has an interesting story, for sure. And I'm going to go slightly out of chronological order just for the effect. These are the sources, the Alcoholics Anonymous World Services. I have the 1976 edition. They've printed some more then, but that's the one that I have. William White is a man that I've heard many times speak. And of all... He had a great mullet. He had wonderful hair, and I was deeply jealous of it every time I saw him. But one of the other things that I just love about is that this man is world-renowned, multiple authorship, helped to create a new mindset to understand recovery. And he's from Bloomington, Illinois. That's where he's called home. That's the training institute. Yay, Illinois. All righty. But... some aspects of the conversions, just a bit of history. I know I'm going to be, again, truncating this, but if I were to zoom down to the last 2 points, just in a nutshell, in the late 19th century, there was actually a strong move to have temperance be the law of the land, and even trying to resurrect what had been tried earlier, the total prohibition. Make booze illegal. Households were being ripped apart. Lives were being lost due to the scourge of alcoholism. Everybody knew it. There had been ebbs and flows of understanding what alcoholism is, where is God in this issue called alcoholism. As you see, there was a lot of outspoken aspect of God, religion is my antidote. He can heal. But some of the history that helped, I think, is really powerful. And I would imagine everybody in this room has heard the term Skid Row. You know, it's been synonymous. You know, Skid Row bum alcoholic is a phrase that I heard for years. Skid Row was actually first termed in Seattle, Washington. Logging, where they would put the logs on the skids. It used to be Skid Road, and then the euphemism was Skid Row. And then in the Boweries in New York. What was happening with alcohol in the culture is that a lot of the undesirable people were taken over. Public intoxication, women entering into prostitution, alcoholism was abundant. You couldn't get away from it. It was in all the neighborhoods, and there was this sense, we've got to have something happen, because alcoholism was not just small town out in the middle of nowhere where people had their stills. It was in the big cities now. It was an urban problem. And then the story of Jerry McAuley is one that is just so powerful. He had a rather unsavory life. You see just a little bit of that. He stole from people. He was certainly a drunk, and he was imprisoned. And he had three profound spiritual experiences. The first two came when he was in prison. One is that a buddy he knew in the jail shared of his own experiences of revival, having been a drunkard. And that was profoundly influential to Jerry. And then there was a person from a church visiting, sharing a religious story. And that was so powerful. I want to just read a section of that. All at once, it seemed as though there was something supernatural was in my room. I was afraid to open my eyes. I was in agony, and the tears just rolled off my face in great drops. How I longed for God's mercy. He's released from prison, fell back into drinking, but he had a third spiritual breakthrough. And I read this to you because it's going to hint, it's a hint of what we'll see in a video clip in just a moment. There was a shock which came into the room, something similar to a flash of lightning. And there were a whole bunch of people in the room who saw it. He dropped to the floor on his side, weeping once again. And he was a changed man after that. And the long and short of it is that he was not only one of them, but he saw all the urban alcoholism plight. And he and his wife and a few others started rescue missions, the Water Street Mission, as you see. There were people in America who were fine to support people who had a drinking problem, but they needed to be respectable people. And Macaulay and his wife Maria, they went and got the people that the rest of society had decided to avoid, ignore, turn a blind eye to. So powerful story for that. The Washingtonians, I actually put these again in out of order because the whole focus of this is to look at the spiritual aspect with recovery. And so I go back in this time because the Washingtonians actually happened in the early part of the 19th century as opposed to what you saw with Jerry Macaulay. The reason why I put that in is that it was a society that in many ways laid a foundation for what we know of Alcoholics Anonymous to be. Many, many principles have been retained for that, from having sponsors and, quote, pigeons to open sharing, working in the community and so forth. But one of the challenges that, well, it helped Washingtonians go from a spreading like wildfire in 1940 to just withering by 1847 is that there was so much dissent, including what role should religion have? When people look back in the past, they say, you know what, there was too much religion with that. What we should have focused on, just making booze illegal, then you would have been fine. Ministers were sometimes jealous because there were people who were incredibly gifted orators spreading their stories, but ministers weren't invited. And so there were some individuals who really thought religion should be in a vital, important part of recovery. Others said, no way. And it fizzled because of a lot of disorganization as well as some principles that were not consistent with Alcoholics Anonymous. And again, just sort of creeping us into the story of Alcoholics Anonymous just very quickly. A fellow who is extremely wealthy and used to be able to buy his way out of any problem, but his booze got the best of him. For those of you familiar with the name, a contemporary of Freud's, Carl Jung. Roland went to Jung trying to get sober. It didn't take. He went back, and Jung's response to him essentially was that, you know, what you need is a spiritual awakening. That's going to be the only thing that will be your salvation from drinking. But here's the bad news, Roland. Doesn't happen too often. Well, Roland was not quite content with the idea that he might be lost at sea forever, so he heard about the Oxford groups that were in England because they were talking about strong spiritual experiences. And he went to America after that. There were people very influential with the Oxford groups. And so you see, as opposed to the Washingtonians, where there was this contrast about whether religion should or shouldn't be part of that, Oxford group was very clear, outspoken about that. So I just have a few of the cornerstone principles, but love, service, commitment, honoring of the Spirit was a major, significant part of the recovery for this. The challenge, as it went on with Alcoholics Anonymous, and we'll look at in just a moment the story of Bill W., but the issues were that For the Oxford group, it was extremely outspoken, religion, be very organized, and down to the point where there were some people who were devoutly Roman Catholic who thought, I'm not sure if I'm going to be invited into this because they are extremely Protestant. And so sometimes there was a concern that it was not just religion, but certain ways to practice religion. And so the spiritual part was there, but not without some question marks. And so connecting the dots, how Bill W., and just a little bit of trivia, if ever you're driving around and you happen to see someone on their vehicle having a bumper sticker that says, a friend of Bill W., that's an individual who's acknowledging that he or she is in recovery, working the steps with Alcoholics Anonymous. So Roland sought Young. Young emphasized spirituality. Went to the Oxford group. Roland carried his inspiration to a buddy that he knew from the work, Ebby, who was in jail. Ebby took it and ran. He visited Bill W., who they had known through their work. Bill was not necessarily real fired up about anything to do with religion, and he was really struggling with recovery. But they visited him, trying to get him involved with an Oxford group. But before he could even utter maybe, he was hospitalized again. And that was a powerful time in his life. And so this is what we will be looking at. That is the direct narrative of what Bill mentioned. All at once found myself crying out, if there is a God, let him show himself. I'm ready to do anything. And then a great white light, which he referred to as his hot flash, caught up in the ecstasy, no words. I was free man. All about me there was a wonderful feeling of presence, capital P. So this is the God of preachers, the one that he had been rejecting, unable to comprehend. So Dr. Silkworth was the one who was talking with him at the very end. And this is how Bill interpreted it. He didn't medicate him, and just as important, he did not invalidate his experience. He said, I can't comprehend it. I'm a man of science, but I can sure tell something is different with you. And notice how poignant that was. If he would have said, as a man of science, a man who we trusted, and Bill Silkworth was the name in the medical world to treat alcoholics. And so if he would have said that, people would have bought his line. So eternally grateful for that. Remember William James, the 1902 definition of religion from earlier this morning. You need to open yourself up to a higher power. And the only cure for dipsomania was religiomania. So these are, I'm just going to skip past this because I know we need to be done. But, well, just point out very quickly, and we'll be done in just a moment. There are a few things that I like. One of them that you'll see over and over again are the words, well, you see in step three, as we understood him, it was a significant difference in principle from the Oxford group, which said you need to understand God a certain way. Not just Bill, but every man who was getting sober needed to approach that in the personal understanding. And so that concept gets pointed out. But you see also there is still strong Christian influence, humbly asking him to remove our shortcomings in step seven. Made a list of all persons we had harmed, became willing to make amends, and then approach them. Talk about how hard that is for any of us, but certainly a man, Bill W., who damaged an awful lot of relationships that he had. And number 12, having had a spiritual awakening, as the result, tried to carry the message. Key word, of course, is anonymous, but share with it one drunk at a time. Serenity Prayer has been pretty much unofficially adopted by the recovering community, and most people are familiar with the first part of that. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and wisdom to know the difference. And then you see the rest of that. AA borrowed, one day at a time, which is now in our vocabulary right and left. So strong, as you see, religious and spiritual undercurrent weaving its way through. And this, to be very sensitive to, going back to one of the first slides I had, my appreciation for Native American, Iroquois Thanksgiving ritual. Speak again and again about him, our Creator. He decided above the world I have created, I will continue to look intently and to listen intently to the earth when people direct their voices at me. Let there be gratitude day and night for the happiness he has given us. He loves us. He who dwells in the sky dwells. He gave us the means to set right that which divides us. That's a good sign. That means I'm done. But I thank you so much. We will be having lunch, and Professor Brewers will be sending us out to the tables.
Thank you for joining us today for NACSW's Podcast of the Month featured selection. We hope you found today's session useful and that it will support your efforts to thoughtfully integrate Christian faith and social work practice. We also hope that you will consider participating in additional NACSW's activities and events, including NACSW's upcoming convention in the fall, our quarterly audio conference workshops that we offer at no cost to NACSW members, and which includes free CEUs accredited by the Association of Social Work Boards, our online continuing education program, and access to dozens of archived podcasts from the members section of our website. Also, we invite you to join NACSW's Facebook group or our Facebook fan page. For additional information about these and other NACSW benefits and services, you can go to our website at www.nacsw.org. Thanks again for listening in today to our podcast session today.